welcome to the Weekly Pulse. I'm Jeff Snyder, founder and CEO of the Morning Pulse, and I'm joined by my friend and colleague and co-host, George Grombacher. George, how are you today, my friend?
I am doing great. I am joining you today from lovely Las Vegas, Nevada.
Wow, Sin City. Well, I hope the weather is sunny, and I hope it's very warm where you are, because it's still very cold here on the East Coast.
Yeah, I was mildly concerned that we might have to postpone everything because you guys were getting dumped on again. But
well, let's hope that doesn't happen. But we did manage to stave off, a big snowstorm. Although some parts of the new Northeast did get hit, so hopefully those folks are digging out. We've got a great show today, George. We've got some great guests. We're going to talk about the Fifth Circuit's DOL fiduciary ruling. There's still some fallout from that, and we're going to have our good friend Groom Law Group's Kevin Walsh on the show. Looking forward to that.
Excellent. Yes, I think that we will be talking about that circuit court's decision for quite some time. So excited to have Kevin back. And of course, the markets are doing what they do. So
yeah, it's kind of a whipsaw. And I think anybody who's watching this, whether you're on the institutional side or the just an average person just watching this, has to have their feel like they're on a roller coaster. So I think we're gonna be lucky. Kevin Kelly. From Bloomberg. He's the equity strategist from Bloomberg Intelligence. He'll be joining us as well on the show, as well as our good friend, TD Ameritrade's anchor, Oliver Rennick. So, George, we're going to learn some new things. We had a lot of stuff go on this week. In addition to the whipsawing of the market, the up and down of the market, we had a new Federal Reserve chairman and a meeting. So we have some news there. And then we've also got some news with regard to some of these tech companies, specifically one as it relates to data breaches. So
right.
That's going to be, I think, a very interesting conversation.
Yeah. And we have the opportunity to talk to Rob Wiley, the executive director of the South Dakota Retirement System. And if I read that correctly, he's got 40 years of experience with that organization. Yeah. So talk about a data set to work off of. So.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a stalwart as it relates to managing pensions and DC plans, and I think they've got some really interesting study that they just released with the help of the Center for State and Local Government Excellence. And let's not forget, we've got two more great guests. We've added a personal finance reporter. Alessandra Melito, or Ali, is a personal finance reporter from Dow Jones's Market Watch, and we thought this would be a great way to get the personal finance aspect of what's going on each week. And I think, George, much of our audience is individuals looking for to kind of keep track of what's going on.
Yeah, and there's been a lot of interesting news, like you talked about the Facebook news coming out, and also Toys R Us, and it is home buying season, so I know that she wants to touch on that. So it should be a great segment.
It should be. And then last but certainly not least, we have Daniel Alexander. He's the CEO of Principal Review. So, one of the things that we've talked about on and on for this show is fees and compensation and what people are earning for their various retirement plans. And Daniel Alexander and his firm are working on this very conundrum, if you will, to kind of make sure that people understand how brokers and advisors are compensated. So it's not bad that people make money. I want to be very clear about that. We're in the business to earn an income, but I think we both agree that making sure that these things are transparent and available to people to understand what they're getting and what it costs, that's very important. You do the same thing with your vehicle when you buy a car, when you buy a toaster, whether you buy your iPad, right?
Yeah, I think that the industry is certainly moving in the right direction of trying to get to absolute transparency so people know exactly who's making money doing what and what everything costs. And to me, it's kind of silly that it hasn't always been that way, but we're getting there. So
we are. So everyone sit back, relax, put on your seatbelt, and George, take off those sunglasses. I know you're sitting out there enjoying the sun, and we're going to go ahead and get started.
Excellent. Let's do it. Joining us now is Kevin Walsh from Groom Law Group, normally from D.C., today in New York. Welcome, Kevin.
Good, thanks. How are you guys today? Thanks for having me on.
Excellent. We are doing well. So I imagine there's still plenty of stuff to talk about in regard to the fiduciary rule. What is going on?
I mean, I think we were fortunate last week that the decision came out the day before we recorded, and it was still breaking news, and I think at this point you could still call it breaking news. The impact Chamber of Commerce versus Department of Labor is going to have on the retirement space, or could have on the retirement space is pretty incredible. When you think about the way the regulatory landscape is changing, 2015, we had the fiduciary proposal. 2016, it came out. 2017, it went live. And now in 2018, it looks like it might be dead.
And is that the feeling now after essentially 1 week has gone by that it's not going to be coming back, or can we expect pieces of it? What are your thoughts or what are your feelings on it?
So I think right now where we are, the most likely path forward is that the fiduciary rule dies. Right now, I'm sure the Department of Labor and the Department of Justice are thinking hard about whether or not they're going to appeal the decision. From an institutional standpoint, the Department of Labor probably has some interest in appealing because this could curtail their ability to issue regulations in the future, such as other regulations where they'd like to interpret words as meaning something other than the common law meaning. Also, it could curtail their regulatory authority, particularly their exemptive authority in the IRA space. On the other hand, if you think about the administration, which is going to have a big say in deciding whether or not to appeal this, the repeal of the fiduciary rule could be consistent with their deregulatory agenda. And if the Department of Labor wants to move on to other priorities, such as making it easier to offer lifetime income, or just getting onto easy stuff like e-disclosure, being able to put the fiduciary rule and the need to essentially continue evaluating it under the president's directive, the Fifth Circuit decision really puts them in a place where they can do that.
Hey, KKev, it's Jeff. So are you starting to get phone calls from, clients or people in the industry, kind of tap into your knowledge and trying to strategically figure out what is coming next? I mean, clearly, this is groundbreaking, as you've articulated, but I'm imagining you're getting phone calls from both service. I mean, obviously you're not going to disclose who your clients are, but service providers and or fiduciaries who were like, okay, what do I need to do, if anything?
Oh my gosh, we're getting a ton of questions because right now, if nothing happens, the rule is vacated on May 7th. Mm-hmm. So I think the first question people are trying to figure out is, will I still be a fiduciary after May 7th? And basically what we've been advising people is that they should inventory their advice programs, inventory their essentially sales programs, and figure out if under the Department of Labor's five-part test, a test that seemed to be gone in 2016, if they would still be a fiduciary after May 7th. And then essentially after inventorying that, you've got to figure out if you still are a fiduciary, what's your source of exemptive relief going to be? And I mean, March 23rd to May 7th, that's not a ton of time.
No.
So there's a big incentive to get inventorying now. Although, I mean, between here and there, there's a lot that can happen. So it's too early to really implement.
Yeah.
That's a lot for big organizations to chew on. And I'm curious from a user perspective, from an employee who's in a retirement plan, how is that, and maybe you can answer this, maybe you can't, maybe Jeff can shed some light on this, how does that really impact the actual plan participant? Can they expect their fees to go up because of this, to remain the same?
So if you're in a plan, it's likely not going to have that big an impact on you. The fiduciary rule really had the biggest impact on the rollover market and on the IRA space. So if you are inside a big plan, there was this thing called, or still is today, because the decision hasn't taken effect, but this independent fiduciary exception, which allowed essentially for sales activity to remain non-fiduciary, despite the fiduciary rule being in effect. In kind of the as an individual, how would this impact you? In all likelihood, the areas where we'd expect to see the biggest impact would be in terms of rollovers. The opinion makes pretty clear that if this is the law of the land, if the Fifth Circuit's ruling that the fiduciary rule is dead is the law of the land, most rollover advice will not automatically be fiduciary advice. So you could see the market segment where there are some offering fiduciary rollover advice and others offering non-fiduciary rollover advice. If I'm an investor here, I mean, my first real thing is I'll need to be aware of the market a little bit better.
Yeah, I think the other thing, George, and you have it's a very astute question, is think about these are not regulations that just were created within the last 3 months. Mm-hmm. These are things that took many years to kind of create. There was a comment period that went on, and then record keepers and broker dealers and everyone had to do a lot of builds and change kind of their operating practices anticipating this change. And so obviously there's costs associated with that. And now that's kind of a sunk cost, although one could argue that their processes have been improved regardless, right? Because they've made changes to the process to make sure that people are making the right recommendations and they're validating them, et cetera. And so I think that's probably a good thing. But there's, you know, kind of like a sunk cost, I would imagine, to put a lot of this stuff in place. And, you know, obviously those dollars have been gone to other projects or things? That's the unanswerable question. But I mean, that's probably another point to this. But I think – go ahead, Kev.
And some financial institutions, some brokerage shops will likely keep some of these reforms in place. While the fiduciary rule may be going away, depending on if there's an appeal of this decision and if that appeal is successful, there's still a number of other regulators to watch. I mean, the SEC has indicated it's trying to get a rule out in the second quarter. States like Nevada and Connecticut have been active in passing essentially fiduciary statutes. If you move away from the best interest standard and still call yourself a best interest advisor, you could face risks from actions like Secretary of the Commonwealth Galvin in Massachusetts, who has expressed an interest in pursuing essentially things that he views as dishonest and unethical practices. The insurance commissioners are active, and you can be sure that congressional Democrats are going to be looking to shine a spotlight if there is bad behavior as a result of the rule going away.
Got it. So as we look into the future and you take out your crystal ball, what are the anticipated next things that we should be on the lookout for in regard to this ruling?
So, I mean, there's an obvious timeline here, and the dates are pretty important. So between now and April 30th, what you want to watch for is you want to see if the Department of Labor appeals the decision. If they file a petition for or request en banc rehearing, then the May 7th day where it goes away may never come. So the first thing to watch is, what's the Department of Labor going to do? I think, as I said before, that the political will to pursue a deregulatory agenda and to move on to other priorities like lifetime income, like e-disclosure, kind of tilt the playing field in favor of dropping the appeal and letting the rule be vacated. On the other hand, you really just watching that Fifth Circuit, seeing if DOL takes action. If it becomes clear that DOL is not going to take action, then you've got to start looking for third parties. It wouldn't be that surprising if a consumer rights group tried to step into DOL's shoes and intervene if DOL were to walk away. Now, intervention's a long shot at this point. It's a very long shot, but at a circuit court level, circuit court judges have a lot of leeway about whether or not to permit someone to intervene. So while I think it's a long shot, the panel or the full en banc court could allow someone to intervene. And then finally, if that day comes and goes, then the next thing to really watch for is whether or not there's a cert petition by June 13th, and if DOL announces anything about their intentions or provides any transition relief. The next 90 days are going to be very exciting.
Excellent. Well, thank you, sir.
Yeah.
Happy to be on.
Thanks, Kevin. Enjoy New York and all we have to offer here. And wish our friend George well, because he's in Las Vegas, Nevada. And please tell him not to gamble. Do not gamble that 401k money away.
George, good luck.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Thanks, Kevin. Have a great weekend. Well, welcome back. And George, that was a great segment with Kevin Walsh, Groom Law. Lots going on in that fiduciary rule. We're going to turn the page a little bit and bring in our experts, our friends from Bloomberg and TD Ameritrade Network. We've got Kevin Walsh, equity strategist from Bloomberg, and we've got the lead anchor for TD Ameritrade Network's Morning Trade Live and Markets on the Close, Mr. Oliver Rennick. Guys, welcome to the show.
What's going on, guys?
Hey.
Howdy, Jeff. What's going on, guys?
Good to see you. Good to hear you, at least. I guess I can't see you, but I see you enough on TV. And just be forewarned, George left his humble abode in Arizona, and he's now in Sin City, Las Vegas, Nevada for the weekend. So wish him luck there.
I hope he makes it back in one piece.
Thank you.
Because stronger men have said less.
Yeah. So, you know, it's obviously been an interesting week. And Oliver, we'll get to you in terms of what you're seeing on your shows and on the TD Ameritrade Network in terms of this up and down market. But Kevin, wanted to start with you. A lot really interesting. The new Federal Reserve Chairman Powell, Federal Reserve meeting. Get your insights on what's kind of happened during the week.
Yeah, no, for sure. And another, I feel like every week we're starting off the same way. Another week, another crazy time in equities. This week we're down, you know, almost 5% for the S&P 500. This is, again, this new kind of volatility regime that started in, you know, really a month ago, a month and a half ago, you know, has really continued. I think what's interesting here, though, is it's not necessarily unprecedented territory. So we did see something similar in terms of price action back in the summer of 2015. For those of you who can remember, you know, you had this kind of what we call a double bottom where the market fell, kind of rebounded a little bit, and then retested those lows. And we're kind of going through that right now. So I know there's a lot of volatility, a lot of uncertainty around, but we're definitely not in uncharted territory as of yet. But yeah, shifting gears, I mean, you had, as you mentioned, Jeff, you had Jerome Powell's first kind of inaugural press conference this week as new Fed chairman, and a couple of key takeaways. I mean, you had the 25 basis point hike in Fed funds target rate. That was pretty much priced in. Dot plot shows about, you know, two more hikes this year, so three total for 2018. Everyone's been kind of on the fence between three and four hikes, but I think in general, economy's looking good. That's what he said. And, you know, the difference between three and four hikes probably won't be too substantial. What I was looking at, though, it kind of jumped out to me, a couple, you know, a little bit more off the beaten path comments. One of which was, he was talking about the job market. It's constantly been a question. There's this tight labor market. And, you know, despite that, we haven't had the wage growth or the inflation growth that people would expect. You know, he's been talking a lot about job creation, things that new job ads can actually absorb, a lot of these new entrants that are coming into the market. And I think that's kind of key here for people who are trying to understand, you know, why wages aren't increasing. For example, you're really starting to see a lot of people come out of the woodwork, people who are outside the labor force coming back in the labor force. And so that's as new jobs are created, you know, that wage growth may not pick up for a little while, despite what most people think. Another, you know, key takeaway, he mentioned housing not being overvalued. That's going to be key because people who can remember, you know, 10 years ago, you know, almost to the day where this was a massive concern, right, obviously. So housing not being overvalued, key commentary there. Finally, he talked about just recessionary risks, right? He was prompted, I forget who asked, but he was prompted about the yield curve flattening, potential yield curve inversion. He said, listen, we don't see that there's above average recessionary risk right now. Yes, we have a flatter yield curve, but I mean, from the work that our team has done, you know, a flatter yield curve doesn't necessarily even mean a headwind for stocks. Stocks can do actually really well in those conditions. It's really not until you see that yield curve inversion where things get a little bit troubling. And we're not in that situation, you know, where we've seen in prior yield curve inversions where you have those long end yields trading lower than short end yields. We don't really have that right now because there isn't a ton of inflationary risk. So the Fed isn't, you know, aggressively hiking rates to try and counter some inflationary risk. So overall, I think it was, you know, kind of same old, maybe a little bit more of a hawkish tone to it. But overall, I mean, a successful first press conference for the new Fed chair.
Well, thanks, Kev. Oliver, now, you know, you've been, you know, covering not only this, but there's a lot going on in terms of the market, in terms of some of these technology companies. There was a privacy breach that was kind of uncovered about a week ago. And there's been a lot going on in the market. So what have you been covering on the show, and what's been top of mind for your viewers and your I mean, you have many viewers on the show. So what's top of mind for you?
Yeah, a lot. And just to follow up on Kevin's point real quick on the yield curve, that question, I believe, was from Miles Udland, came in from Yahoo Finance. And I, too, thought it was a good question. There was a lot going on, right? There was kind of bottom falling out of two really important groups by every definition to the S&P 500 and the stock market as a whole. And it's technology and it's financial companies. And the social media story was paramount at the start of the week, with Facebook coming under fire the use of their data, misuse, breach, whatever you want to call it, sink in the stock. Now, stocks has been pretty tough. It hasn't been a very reliable name for the FANG group since, I mean, it's pretty much flat back to October. So, you know, yeah, today we're pushing levels back to September, so it's not great for Facebook. But the interesting thing about this entire group for technology is the fact that they are getting beat up on the downside just as much as everything else is. Now, yes, there's, I think, social media kind of concern, right? Because you're getting into a space here that could start to get close to that magic R word, regulation. And I think that that was very interesting to see how that played out, because I was wondering if we were going to see another instance in which Facebook got torn apart, but Twitter bounced to the upside. If you remember earlier in the year when Zuckerberg announced the change to the news feed, there was essentially a mirror image between Facebook and Twitter shares. That didn't happen this time around, which means that some kind of macro concern for these companies crept in. It's probably regulatory. But then on top of that, you also have these this amount of selling that happens in the market, and then also, you know, back to that big topic of the Fed, because the financial group is not excluded from this. And there's arguably nothing more important here. I mean, we've been talking about this on the network since we started, which was in October. By the end of 2017, the rally in the financial companies just didn't make any sense. I mean, we've been talking about it constantly. There are all these expectations about what was going to happen for rates. But during that period, the 10-year yield moved up like 20 basis points. It basically went nowhere. Financials rallied 20%. Their earnings sucked by most definitions. I mean, the trading desks are just continuing to struggle. Now, a lot of those banks were able to beat expectations, but it still was, you know, revenue losses across the board. So this didn't make – it makes a lot of sense that this company is not – these companies are not holding up. Now you've got basis points about 40 basis points higher in the 10 years since that period in which things didn't really make sense and banks getting hit. So maybe this is a place where they can try and get a better narrative, but – this was just a part of this market that was just waiting to get hurt. And it, you add those two together, and the market's just not going to do better when you got tech and financials. It's just math.
Yeah. Well, I'm always grateful when smart guys come on the show to explain all this stuff to me. So thank you guys for that information. Something that I'm curious about, and I hate to maybe sidetrack, but whenever the Fed comes out and talks about how they're going to be raising interest rates, or they do actually raise interest rates, to the everyday average American consumer, how should they respond to that? Does that mean that interest rates on a home mortgage could be going up? How does that really manifest itself to regular folks?
I can take a swing at that real quick and then get Kevin's thoughts, just because we just had somebody talking about that, Lynette Calfani Cox. Ask the Money Coach. She's kind of our credit go-to. And, you know, I think it starts to add up, especially when you see how much Americans swiped their credit cards at the end of the last year. I mean, it was debt and debt, not so much on the millennial side, but a lot of Americans are willing to take on some debt. Eventually it adds up. But, again, I think that when you look historically, it's just still a pretty low-rate environment. I mean, we're having trouble. We're struggling to get through that three area, so I think you got to, you know, every average person has to keep their mind on it. But that's kind of my take. It's kind of a simple take, but I'd be curious to hear what Kevin thinks.
Yeah, no, I mean, I would agree with a lot of what you're saying there, Oliver. I think just to kind of add to that and follow up a bit, you know, I wouldn't say anybody or advise anybody to really, especially if you're a retail or individual investor, try and trade around, you know, these individual rate decisions or press conferences. I mean, 25 basis points in the grand scheme of things isn't huge, but when you look at it collectively and you look at where, you know, I referenced the dot plot earlier, which is essentially just where the Fed thinks, just based on the constituents, where they think rates, short-term rates will be, you know, over time, right? So when you look at that, through, let's say, 2020, that's rates appear to be a little bit higher than what was expected at the beginning of this year, but not substantial, especially when you look at the history of long-term rates, which we're still in that low-rate environment. Final comment, just bringing it back to the equity markets, too. I think when you look at the situation we're in, the relative value or the attractiveness, you could say, of stocks right now is because you're in this low-rate environment, and where you're going to get that additional yield, right? That's for institutional investors who have to put people's money to work, or even retail investors. And so as you see, you know, two-year yields tick up, even 6 months, you can get 2%, almost 2% now on a six-month T-bill. You know, that starts to threaten a bit the attractiveness of equities, especially at higher valuation levels. So I would say, just kind of in summary, again, echoing Oliver's point, not a huge, I wouldn't advise anything, any major changes, but definitely something you want to keep in mind of over the long term to kind of weigh, you know, how attractive the stock market would be for investing there versus, you know, some fixed income investments.
Yeah. George, I would weigh in and just say that, you know, we're all advocating, obviously, for long-term investing and people taking that long-term view. And it's interesting because I just read a study, I don't know, not recently, but within the last couple of weeks, that during the last downturn, you know, people kind of learned the lessons of 2008 and didn't move their money around. So there wasn't this massive shift. So I think people have learned some of those lessons. But it is hard. It can be very scary. And we're going to have on in the next segment Alessandro Melito from Dow Jones Market Watch, kind of give the personal finance perspective. But I think if you're the average person, the average retail investor, sitting back, you know, you were just lauding the great returns you had on social media on your 401k, and now all of a sudden this happens. And it's kind of that up and down, that whipsaw, the market, I think can be very disconcerting to people.
It could be. Well, there's something that I wanted to make sure to touch on, and I want to put Oliver on notice that Kevin has been training with Hall of Fame wide receiver Chris Carter. So I don't know what you've been doing, Oliver, but you better up your game, bro.
I've been playing a lot of Madden NFL 18, okay. So I think I'm pretty ready to take this competition to the next level.
All right. Well, as I said in the intro online, I think we're gonna have the retirement combine. So I'll just be overseeing it with a stopwatch. And you guys can all participate because I'm in not good shape, even though I've been doing Pilates regularly for the last 3 months. So guys, wish you all the best. Have a great time on your respective shows and networks. And we'll
Thanks,
talk
Jeff.
To you
Thanks,
all
George.
This time next week.
Thanks, guys.
Have a great weekend.
Have a good luck in Las Vegas.
Thanks.
Bye. Well, George, we've got a great guest. Robert Wiley, who's the executive director of the South Dakota Retirement System, is stopping by. And there was just a new white paper that came out discussing the impact of automatic enrollment in 457 plans for the South Dakota public employees. And so, Rob, thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
No, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So, you know, this was a great paper. I think it's a great story. And wonder if you wouldn't mind sharing with the audience. So the audience, just for your best, you know, knowledge, is both institutional but also individual. So it could be people from around the country or even around the globe who want to learn the latest trends or hear about the latest things that are going on in the world of retirement. So, you know, feel free to enlighten us of what's going on in South Dakota.
Sure. You know, this project, and this is just one piece of what I envision as a very long project. It goes back, clear back into the 1980s and 90s when we recognized that maybe we weren't saving enough to help our public employees to make the right decisions about being ready for retirement. And so back in the 80s, we established the Supplemental Retirement Plan, and SDRS is primarily a defined benefit plan, but sponsored the 457. It grew through the years, and you know, for about 20 years, it was maybe a little bit of slow growth, but we realized that what we needed to do back in the early 2000s is that we needed to take a look at what the private side was doing with all of their automatic enrollment programs and the successes of them, and brought automatic enrollment back in 2008, which we established in 2009. It started off well. We found out that there were some nuances about it that were unexpected, but we ended up adding auto escalation to the program in 2015, and it's moved along nicely. I've been really happy to work with the people at the Center for State and Local Government Excellence, Josh Franzel and Bob Clark from North Carolina State University, to do a couple papers, and then one that just is out really looks at what is kind of a long-term view of how it has gone. And we're excited to say that for the most part, for those people who are eligible for auto enrollment and auto escalation, we probably are doing more than 80% better participation rates for them than we were for those that chose not to do auto enrollment. So the numbers have just been outstanding.
Well, that's great news, George.
That is outstanding, and I'm sorry, you said 2008 is when you put the auto enrollment into place.
Yes.
All right. So 10 years, that's a good sample size, and 80%, that is exceptional.
South Dakota is still a small state compared to many others, but I think there certainly is the possibility that some of this performance, and maybe South Dakota had some special issues with it, but I think it's certainly something that maybe other states or local governments would find interesting. It really, in my part, the defined contribution plans are terrific as a supplement. All of my members here in South Dakota are members of the defined benefit plan, but they're also in Social Security, and we're trying to replace, when we consider everything, about 85% of their pre-retirement income. Well, it's hard to replace that much income from just the defined benefit and Social Security, and we really think the defined contributions, these voluntary plans, are just a great way to fill any shortfall.
Yeah, and that's what I've, guys, this is what I really love about this program is, when you read the popular press today, and Rob, you and I have talked ongoing over the years about this, and we both attend NASRA and other industry functions. It's not one or the other. This is two different types of programs working together to provide benefits. So you don't have to be all DB or all DC. This is an example where the two systems can supplement, or the DC can supplement the DB plan. And that's what I think is a really great lesson here. And let me just say, for the audience, if they want to check out your paper or the paper that was written, they can go to the SLGE website. That's available at www.slge.org, and it's right there, right on the homepage.
And Jeff, you just hit on what I consider the most important thing in this, is that you use all of these vehicles to get to the place that you need to get to provide the opportunities for public employees that you have as your members, to between Social Security, between their defined benefit plan and their defined contributions that are probably supplemental for most public plans, public employees. Really, you need the whole picture to make it really work the way it should.
Yeah.
I think it's exciting that you've been able to successfully implement it. And if I'm not mistaken, Rob, you've been with the South Dakota retirement system for almost 40 years. And so that's a good amount of experience. When you started to consider putting in the auto enrollment and then the auto escalation, I'm curious what your biggest concerns were, and now looking back, have any of those played out?
Of course, thank you. Those are great questions. Yeah, the greatest concerns, of course, are is that, you have to be concerned that, we're not a rich state. We don't pay big wages, and anything that would effectively limit take-home pay from an individual, this is a little bit of a scary thing. You don't want to be in a situation that you're trying to be so paternalistic that you don't pay attention to that. And so we didn't know really how it would come out, and how great it was to realize that for the most part, most of these people just needed a nudge. The inertia of making that decision was too hard. So to do a nudge that effectively automatically enrolled them is just turned out super. And then over the years, the one that really surprised us, that was probably not on the good side, was that once you got members into the auto enrollment and into the plan, you had to give them a nudge to get them to auto escalate. Mm-hmm. We got through the first 6 or 7 years here, about 2015 and 14 and 15, we started analyzing it, and a big percentage of the people who were auto enrolled didn't escalate their contributions. And so ultimately we needed to do that and do the auto escalation. Well, it happened the same way. 90% of the people who were in auto enrollment accepted the auto escalation once it wasn't something that they had to decide, kind of themselves. In fact, it happened automatically. And so there's some just fascinating behavioral economics issues that come with something like this. And we're going to take it one step further. And Jeff, you and I talked about this before. It was last October, but we went into the legislature here this year and proposed that we do an automatic re-enrollment of every single person. Remember, we did this only for new hires. Now we're going to go in and effectively enroll everyone who's in state government and other employers if they choose to do that. And we won't get maybe as quite as good of a response because some of these people are closer to retirement and may have decided on other savings. But it was gratifying. We ended up, the legislature passed that change unanimously again. We got every single legislator to say this is a good idea. And so we'll be implementing that in the next year. And so we'll try and take it to the next step.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, I think this is amazing. I think it's, very progressive. And, this is kind of a roadmap, I think, George, for other states, municipalities, I think, as Rob alluded to kind of consider. I mean, it doesn't have to be going back to the either or statement that oftentimes we see, kind of played out in the press and on television about DB or DC. I think this is really a great way to work through things. You've got a 10-year time horizon. I'm sure there was a lot of feasibility work that was done in advance to get the legislature and all the stakeholders comfortable. And I would imagine, Rob, that there was also a lot of work done to educate and communicate to participants both about the auto enrollment, about the and auto escalation, I would presume about the auto re-enrollment as well when you eventually roll that out.
That is exactly true. That's key to the whole success, is that you communicate, you educate. In fact, what we have done in each of these situations is say we passed the legislation in 2008, but we're not going to implement until 2009, just so that we have a full year for education and communication. We're doing that. We did that with the auto escalation, and we're doing it here. We won't actually implement this year. We'll implement next year so that we have time to bring everybody into the knowledge base that we hope they have and hope that will help them make good decisions. We don't expect to have the same kind of response in this one, but you're right. It's a stair step that you have to go through to do one, then the other, then the other. I don't know if there's another one beyond it, but we'll have to figure that out later. But so far, they seem to be moving along the way we would hope they would.
Well, theory versus practice, and it's really exciting that you have this body of now evidence and it's working, and I will definitely keep a close eye on how the next step goes. So very exciting.
Well, Rob,
and my only added point is what we've already talked about. It's the combination of including all of these pieces that really is the exciting thing about this, is that it's not just the DB, it's not just the DC, it's not, it's the including of Social Security. It's bringing all these things together in a way that really serves those members.
Well, Robbie, I want to thank you very much for joining us on the show. And just to remind our audience again, if they have not done so, they can go out and view this great white paper on the Center for State and Local Government Excellence website, www.slge.com, and they can check out the work of Josh Franzell and his team, as well as the University of North Carolina. Is that correct? Did I get that right, Rob?
Yes, that's right.
Well, great, Rob. Thank you so much, and we look forward to having you back on the show. Maybe we can get some regular check-ins with you and the team over the course of the next year.
They'd be happy to visit.
Thanks,
Jeff. Thanks, George.
Thank you.
Call me anytime for whatever you need.
Excellent.
Thank you. Thanks, Rob.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Joining Jeff and I now is Alessandra Melito, a personal finance reporter with MarketWatch. Allie, how are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
We are doing great. We are doing great. There is a little bit of news with everybody's favorite social media site, Facebook. I don't know if you caught that information or not, but...
Yeah. Facebook has been the news all week here in the newsroom. Everybody's been talking about it and taking different angles on it, and there's been a lot of blame placed on a lot of different people and parties. But as a personal finance reporter, I obviously value what this means for consumers. So colleague Maria LaMagna, she had actually taken this really cool take on what the Facebook situation, privacy situation, means for consumers, like why they should be worried and what it comes down to. Obviously, with the news about Cambridge Analytica and them being able to access personal data, the question really comes down to what is that data and what does them or others having access mean? So one thing is, you know, the dark web being that part of the internet that people can access very important data and like social security accounts and passwords and things like that by using special software. It turns out that Facebook logins are actually being sold for like around $5.20. That allows criminals to have access to personal data that would be even more dangerous, such as like PayPal accounts or credit card numbers and things like that. I thought that was really interesting.
So, Allie, is this a hot topic not only in the newsroom, but this is a hot topic for individuals throughout the country, that people that are viewing the MarketWatch website, that are following, trying to do budgeting, or is this a big issue for them?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would say so. Considering so many people use Facebook, it's a little scary to think about the fact that your financial information can be hacked from your Facebook, mm-hmm. and that it's actually, these logins are being sold. And I personally get emails sometimes from Facebook for security measures saying, oh, somebody tried logging into your account or changing the password. If it's not you, let us know. And it's not me that's doing that. So it's a little concerning.
Yeah, I would say so.
It should be very, very interesting to find out what actually happens with this. I heard that the Federal Trade Commission is investigating, and potentially the fines could be $40,000 per occurrence.
And oh, wow.
That number comes out to be some goofy number, like $3 trillion or something like that. I may be making that up, but...
Wow. No, yeah, so one of my colleagues wrote about that as well, and said that it's probably not likely that it's going to be as much per account, but just the idea that this is real life, and these accounts are under fire and at risk is just very scary, especially given the fact that there have been security breaches at other major retailers and Equifax last year. So it's very easy to access your financial information. And that's actually why the accounts are not as expensive as you would think they would be on the dark web, just because this data is becoming easier and easier.
Yeah.
So the actual value to a hacker is less and less because the information is more readily available. That's that's kind of a sad state of affairs.
So like an entire online identity, such as like personal identification numbers and financial accounts, can be sold for about $1,200 on the dark web. But according to an analysis from content marketing agency Fractal. But I mean, if you think about it, that's a lot of personal and valuable information, and you would think that it would be a little more expensive, but it's not, because these accounts are so easy to find and easy to hack nowadays with these breaches and privacy issues.
And I know that along with Facebook in the news, there's also been news about Toys R Us. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so starting this weekend, Toys R Us has their liquidation sales going on. All 735 Toys R Us and Babies R Us stores, which the company filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy last year, they're going out of business. Sales have started. Does that mean that people should be rushing to the stores? It depends. So if you're looking for very specific toys like Lego sets or Barbies or Star Wars and things like that, you probably do want to go there sooner rather than later, but the deals aren't going to be as good. A lot of people assume that liquidation sales means that you're going to see crazy sales and discounts and all that stuff, but what it actually means is that the company might be increasing prices to the manufacturer's suggested retail price before it does these discounts, So the savings will be very minimal. If you are the bargain hunter like I am, then you might, and you don't have something very specific that you're looking for, you might want to hold off. I know that parents and family members and me, I know for sure me, I'm going to be holiday shopping, taking this time to go holiday shopping. And that means that I'll see the best deals probably in a couple of weeks or a couple of months. The thing to note, though, is that some stores will probably be closing by the end of April, and a lot of stuff will be off shelves sooner rather than later. So you'll probably see more basic toys at the end of all of this.
Got it.
Yeah,
nice.
George, I'm going to miss Jeff with the giraffe, because I remember as a kid going to Toys R Us and picking up Star Wars figures or my Army men. So, and I remember those commercials. So I'm really disappointed by that. Allie, what else is, you know, I know you kind of picked through the top stories of the week. What else is top of mind from a budgeting or retirement or personal finance perspective in the eyes of MarketWatch?
So a few things. One other thing is obviously it's tax season. Everybody is getting ready to file if they haven't already. Actually, the IRS has already received 78 million returns, 75 million of which have already been processed.
Wow.
So one thing to note is that there are a lot of myths going on and misconceptions going on over your taxes. So I have a couple of suggestions for what people can do.
Great.
So one, people give advice all the time, but sometimes people probably shouldn't give advice. One of the myths that happens in the tax time arena is if you get an extension, then you'll have more time to pay your taxes. That is just wrong. The extension only means that you have more time to file, not more time to pay. So if you are in a situation where you can't pay all of your taxes at once, then you should give what you can and then go on a payment plan with the IRS. So that's the big thing that we hear all the time. Another thing is, like, you don't have to report money from a side hustle. you should do. obviously, the better advice would be to report all of your income, even if it was paid in cash or if it was you didn't get your W-2, just because that's the right thing to do. And another thing, surprisingly, a lot of people say that you buy real estate for tax breaks, but that's not really the best advice, because some people, it doesn't make sense for them to buy a house. So to do it just for a tax break is a very stressful piece of advice, in my opinion. obviously, people should be buying real estate because it makes sense for them and not for their tax filing purposes. Which actually leads me into another thing that's been happening in the news. Obviously, it's the first week of spring, even though I'm in New York and it doesn't feel like it. We had a major snowstorm the other day. but regardless, spring is the most popular time to buy a home. And this year, that season, the home buying season, is supposed to be more competitive than ever before due to various factors that include rapid appreciation in home prices, market rates that are increasing, and the fact that there just aren't that many homes being sold because either homeowners aren't interested in selling at the moment or home builders haven't made enough.
Nice. Well, that is a lot of good information there. And what I want to for sure echo is that Big Brother is watching, so please do report all that income that you are making from your primary hustle or your side hustle or any other hustle. So,
and I want to put out, I want to put out for the record that we're not making any money on this podcast. So the government should look elsewhere. Sorry, Allie, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Allie.
Oh no. Another thing, just as far as side hustles go, there's a difference between having an actual side hustle and having a hobby. And you hear all the time people are afraid that they're going to get audited for whatever reason, one of which is like taking a home office deduction. Those sorts of things, if you actually qualify for these deductions, you should be taking the deduction, obviously. Red flags for the IRS, according to some of the experts that I spoke with, are more along the lines of like claiming losses on hobbies that, you know, maybe should be registered as an actual job that you're looking to make money from, and things like withdrawing from a retirement account early. So just to keep in mind that another myth that goes around Market Watch is that you shouldn't take certain deductions just because you might face an audit. I mean, if you qualify for these deductions, it's okay to take the audit, to take the deduction.
Excellent. Well, Allie, excellent first segment. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, George, it's been a great show thus far, and I'm very, we've been talking about the market, we've been talking about personal finance, and now we're going to bring on the CEO and Managing Director of Principal Review, Mr. Daniel Alexander. Dan, great to talk to you today.
Hey, guys, thanks for having me.
Daniel, I know that your organization, Principal Review, has really been focused on another aspect of the fiduciary audit, where, in addition to not only negotiating fees, which is typically done by consultants, and picking share classes, your firm has been working on evaluating compensation structures for brokers, advisors, and the people the likes, right?
Yeah, that's right. For quite often, the traditional scope of work that's been taken on by many plan consultants and fiduciaries has really been to look at fee structure, by fee benchmarking, investment performance, reviewing that investment performance with the plan sponsors that they're currently working with. But the area that we really dial in on are those conflict of interest structures that exist with plan record keepers and plan providers as they provide service to plan participants. And one of those key areas has to do with compensation. And as we all know, if you take a step back and we look at what's been taking place in the group retirement markets and the defined contribution markets, we've had this fee compression that's taken place. And as a result of that fee compression, record keepers and plan providers that want to continue to receive revenue look for alternative ways to do that. And one of the ways is, one, by selling ancillary products to these defined contribution participants. And the other way is reviewing how they're currently paying their plan representatives. So whether it's an agent, whether it's an insurance investment broker, whether it's an investment advisor, they change the form of the compensation that might be provided to these individuals. And in doing so, they change the incentive. They change the goalpost, and these advisors engage in activities that could very well not only engage the plan, but can also impact retirement outcomes for plan participants.
Yeah, you are doing very, very important work. And from my experience working with retirement plans, there have certainly been a lot of impactful and important changes in transparency and compensation over the past several years, but there's still a long ways to go.
Sure.
How would you counsel a company or an individual to be able to diagnose whether or not the compensation that they are paying for their retirement plan is fair and reasonable?
Yeah, and it's a great way to look at it. And there's really two forms of compensation that you look at. It's the compensation provided to the provider and the compensation that might be provided to a plan representative that's employed by that provider. So what we've embarked on is developing a tool that allows us to take a very subjective and highly complex matter, right, and quantify that in a way that a fiduciary or a plan sponsor can take a look at this and say, you know what, I get it. I now understand what's happening inside of my plan, and they can make necessary changes based on recommendations that we provide to that plan. And so some of the items that we look for is, one, what is the form of compensation that's been communicated to the plan sponsor? Okay? Or in this case, the co-fiduciary that might be servicing over the plan. And depending on that form of compensation, we hear a number of different things, right? And it ranges, that we've all heard of it, from salary, and it ranges to straight commission, and then you have something in the middle. What will often happen is depending on the structure that provider allows for in that group, and that's accepted by that fiduciary, individuals might engage in sales practices that are outside the scope and the sale of non-disclosed product to plan participants. Now, what that ends up happening there is you end up generating, particularly in the ERISA markets, right? You end up generating a form of provider revenue that goes undisclosed to the plan sponsor and to the fiduciary. And what we know through Section 408B2 is that all forms of direct and indirect compensation need to be communicated. And so when you intentfully or you willfully reduce the form of compensation paid to those plan representatives, and you subsidize that, well, here's opportunities to sell non-plan related product, you end up generating compensation that is goes unaware, that is not disclosed properly to the fiduciary and the plan sponsor, and ends up creating an ERISA risk, ends up creating a fiduciary risk for the plan sponsor. And moreover, it can potentially even create litigation risk, right? Participants that end up purchasing product and purchasing services under the guise of some form of implicit endorsement that their employer has given to these product providers and investment providers, end up purchasing these additional products without realizing that these individuals may not be compensated the way it was communicated to them, salary or otherwise, but yet they're actually making commissions and generating undisclosed revenue as a result of these products and services.
Okay. I'm a person who likes examples of things. Would an example of what you're talking about be the financial advisor at my company's, the financial advisor who helps with my company 401k plan came to my office and I sat down with him and he sold me a mutual fund or a 529 college savings plan and he received compensation on that?
You know, that would be a perfect example. So if you take a 401k plan, in this case, that would be governed by ERISA, and the plan hired, you know, XYZ investment provider to provide these services. And with that, they had a financial advisor or a plan representative that would meet with the individual employees of that plan. And that advisor was to come to your office and, outside the scope of that plan, provide you or solicit to you a 529 plan, possibly an insurance product, maybe an annuity contract to help with guaranteed income. All of these items that were proposed to you, those could fall outside of the scope of the compensation structure that was originally communicated to the plan. And so if the compensation structure that was originally communicated to the plan was these investment advisors make salary, or these investment advisors make salary and some additional kind of bonus component, yet they were out there soliciting products that might generate other non-disclosed form of compensation through the sale of non-disclosed product, that would create a fiduciary issue for that plan sponsor.
Got it.
I would say this is even probably more important. I don't want to lead the witness here, Daniel, sure. But I think this is probably even more. But I will.
Please go ahead.
I would think this is even more important given the Fifth Circuit's ruling last week, and we actually covered that this earlier in the show with Kevin Walsh from Groom Law. But I got to think that it's more important now given some of these changes, and we're also waiting for the SEC for their fiduciary rule and whatnot. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the reality is, look, the fact that the DOL will come out with a fiduciary rule, the fact that the SEC is taking steps to create some form of rule on their own, it shows the market, look, there is a problem here, and there is a problem that needs to be addressed. But I think what is fair to be able to say in this market and any other market is that laws do not stop crimes. At the end of the day, plan participants, plan fiduciaries, and plan sponsors need to take proactive steps in order to defend themselves against either future litigation, I guess breach of fiduciary duty, and participants need to protect themselves against sales practices that may not be in their best interest. And so to the extent, as a private organization, whether it's us and other entities that are engaged in this new world of transparency, are able to provide services at a very high level that can help not only protect individuals against these types of sales practices, but can protect plans against future litigation as a result of some sales practices that go undisclosed to them, I think all the better. But, you know, the DOL and what the Fifth Circuit has done, you know, we'll see what comes of that. You know, we very well still may have a DOL fiduciary rule, you know, a year or two down the road. But what will not happen is that there will continually be a desire by organizations, particularly, as is a for-profit world, to be determined to find ways to continue to generate revenue. And to the extent that that revenue goes undisclosed, to the extent that that revenue is generated by offering products and services that are not being fairly disclosed to plan participants and the fiduciaries that run those plans, will require organizations like ourselves to bring those types of transactions to the light of day.
I think that's excellent, and I think that it's much needed. And the more we can be upfront about who's making money, who's being compensated, and how much, I think that it's all for the best. You can tell me if I'm right or wrong, but great advice to people that are listening if they're curious about this, maybe simply to have a conversation with your providers and say, hey, We greatly value the services that you're providing. I just want to be really clear and have a good understanding of how much you're charging and how you're being compensated for your services. Go ahead.
Yeah, that is a fabulous point. And, you know, the code allows, particularly in the ERISA markets, you know, the code provides for fiduciaries. Again, whether it's a co-fiduciary or the actual plan sponsor themselves, the code allows for fiduciary to broadly ask questions to help best protect their plan. And some of the what I've witnessed as we've gone from coast to coast and meeting with different plan consultants and plan sponsors and other fiduciaries is there's a number of, particularly plan sponsors, have it almost seems this fear to ask how much money are you making. It almost seems like it's a bit taboo to ask that, right? Sure. It's impolite to ask people how much money they make. But these are important questions to ask, not only to fairly identify the structure and the nature of that compensation, but to identify how much is being made. Mm-hmm. And the reason why how much is being made is if you're told that the advisors or the representatives servicing your plan are making a salary or a salary plus bonus, but you end up learning that that salary or salary plus bonus, which is very common, we found, is some very nominal number. You know, it's a number that's just in maybe in the single digit thousands, you know, or sorry, in the four digit thousands, or it's a couple hundred dollars. It's something that's incredibly nominal. That begs to ask yourself a follow-up question that says, well, exactly how are you making your money? And that's where you really begin to uncover what the true incentives are of these individuals that are on campus. You begin to uncover the different products and services that are being sold to these participants. And where a plan sponsor, in asking these questions, really wants to be careful is if you put these individuals in front of your employees, it would be natural and it can be reasonable for one to think that this investment provider has your endorsement. And when they start selling other product, it is natural for these employees to think that, well, these products have been vetted. And the reality is that they haven't been vetted, they haven't been looked at, and it's unrecognized by the sponsor. So I would answer your question more directly, I would urge plan sponsors and fiduciaries to start asking some more difficult questions as it relates to exactly how people are paid, mm-hmm. and what are the other non-cash incentive structures that are used to encourage and motivate plan representatives that are on site.
Well, Daniel, can't thank you enough for joining us in the show, and hopefully you can come back throughout the year and kind of share what you've learned along the way. And I think, George, what this really means, I think, you know, things that Daniel's suggesting, you know, we often talk about the committee meeting and what happens in that committee meeting. And so we really need to go beyond just fees, the record keeping fees. We need to go beyond the investment performance, although those things are all important. But we really need to go and talk about other issues like what Daniel's suggesting, communication, education. So I think there's a lot of room there. A lot of meat for future discussion. So,
Good stuff.
I guess I'm on a soapbox. But Daniel, thank you so much for joining us. And
yeah,
we'd love to have you come back later on this year.
Thanks, Daniel.
Absolutely, that would be great. Take care, fellas. Bye-bye. Bye.
Well, George, it was a great show. What a lot of great information, don't you think?
As always, everybody delivered solid info for us, and certainly helped me fill in a lot of the gaps of the week's news. So good stuff.
Yeah, I think the show is really kind of beginning to be, you know, take form, and you know, it's a one-stop shop for all things retirement, all things financial services in the markets, and hopefully people can tune in, give us some feedback, constructive feedback, of course, and we can continue to make the show better. So wish you all the best in Vegas.
Thank
Have
you.
Have fun with
Thank
your friends.
You. I appreciate
and,
it.
Look forward to catching up with you next week as we go head forward to our next show.
Thanks, everybody, for listening, and we'll talk to you soon.